as a guest in New Haven on a Chubb Fellowship, which each year brings leading American political figures to meet the students of Yale's Timothy Dwight College.
How do you feel about being a Chubb Fellow?
Well, a little nervous at the moment, but then I was always nervous about an examination.
Could you tell me in what ways you've been active for civil rights in your career?
Well, you're looking at a fellow that thought about it and was concerned about it long before it was called civil rights. I began my career out of college as a sports announcer. And I was long one of the militant voices in that particular fraternity, and in the sports world, I broadcast Major League Baseball against the discrimination in which in organized baseball, Negroes weren't allowed to play. And finally, Branch Rickey took the step, and baseball was better for it.
Do you think the Rumford Fair Housing Act in California is an ineffective or a bad method of assuring fair housing legislation, of assuring open housing?
I think that the Rumford Fair Housing Act in California runs a very great danger and risk in attempting to achieve something that I desire very much and all of us should desire. It runs the risk of, by precedent, giving to government a power that government should not have and that can someday come back to haunt us, can be used for other than worthy purposes. And this is the infringement on the right of the individual to private possessions and the control, ownership of those possessions. Now, there's a great difference between the restrictive covenant idea and the individual being told what he can or cannot do with his own home. Now, strangely enough, and I know this will sound strange to many of you in view of what you've read, you happen to be looking at someone who spent a lifetime rather militantly and emotionally opposed to discrimination and bigotry. As a sports announcer many years ago, when baseball, organized baseball, opened its rule book with a line, "Baseball is a game for Caucasian gentlemen." As a sports announcer, I editorialized constantly against this. And can now point with sort of I told you so pride to the wonderful progress that baseball has made because Branch Rickey had the courage to do what he did. As I say, I would not knowingly patronize a place of business that conducted its business with discrimination, bigotry, or prejudice. I would urge all right-thinking people to do the same.
Everybody, that's the sound of the Vanilla Fudge right there. It's called You Keep Me Hanging On, an old Supreme song done but a new way on Jan the Man's New Generation, WIBC AM and FM. Hey, by the way, you be sure to listen to WIBC's Viewpoint. That's Wednesday at 8:30 when Jason Roberts talks with Governor Ronald Reagan. Right here where news strikes first, it happens to you on Wibbick Radio.
Okay.
All
right.
Okay. Wait a second.
Roll the tape. Governor, at your news conference on Monday, you said that you didn't feel there was anything wrong in this country that would necessitate breaking the law in order to change the situation. Is that correct?
That's right.
The civil rights movement, as I recall, progressed by breaking laws in the South and getting them tested in the courts. Can you see an analogous situation with the Vietnam War?
No, and I disagreed with the whole theory of civil disobedience. Because, again, you impose on the rights of others. It's very easy to say we're going to have a demonstration and it's going to be civil disobedience. And you can make it sound as if all we're doing is going against the county supervisors or the city council's refusal to grant us a parade permit. It doesn't stop there.
According to yesterday's Yale Daily News, you said on Monday that, quote, "I don't think there is anything that justifies a man taking the law in his own hands," unquote. Let's imagine a hypothetical situation in which an American is ordered by the government to go to war and kill people for what he considers inadequate reasons. He feels that obeying the law would be totally immoral. After reading about the Nuremberg trials, he decides that to disobey the law is the only just and moral thing to do. Do you think that such a man is, quote, justified in taking the law in his own hands?
Well, we have a provision in this country for the conscientious objector on the basis of religious scruple or belief
restriction only applies to people who are opposed to all wars. I'm talking about the person who is interested and would interested in defending his country against foreign aggression, and who would gladly defend his country against aggression if called upon. But this person also decides that there are other wars which he cannot fight morally. And the Selective Service Act does not allow for such, quote, selective conscientious objection.
Well, I have to say then that you're asking for a premise that I believe is untenable if we're to continue to have civilization and to have law and order. Because what you're asking for then is the right of the individual to determine to his own satisfaction when is the country endangered. And it may very well be that our country decides that it is better, that the country is endangered, and it's better to fight the war someplace else than on the shores of California or Oregon or even on the East Coast.
Now, what you're saying then is that the law, what the government says, should be the ultimate thing in determining what an individual does. And I thought that this was specifically what was condemned at Nuremberg, and that people who hold your point of view were convicted of crimes against humanity.
You're tying two subjects together here. The rightness or wrongness of what was done at Nuremberg is a different issue, and has long been debated with regard to its rightness or wrongness. But what I'm saying with regard to any law in a system that more than any other system that has ever been created by man gives the individual citizen the right of redress, the right of protest, the right of peaceful revolution at the ballot box, and even provides not waiting for the ballot box or the election day by way of impeachment and recall, all of these things have been built in. And what you really, in effect, are saying, although you want to put it in the highly emotional area of peace and war and killing and not killing, you are simply asking that we try to have a nation of laws and yet give the individual the right to choose which laws, which national policy he will obey. And if you do that, I don't see any other recourse but that we are reverting back to the war of who can, or the business of who can carry the biggest club.
Well, I think you can make a distinction between laws which require somebody to go out and kill people and laws which require him to drive on the right side of the road and pay taxes to his government. I mean, there's a clear distinction. And what you seem to be saying is that moral values should have absolutely no effect on whether or not a person does what his government says he should do.
Well,
I mean, you seem to assume that the government of the United States is always going to make the morally correct decision. What about what about people like the colonists who defied the law of the British?
We set up this system of ours is because those people left a form of government in which they did not have redress or did not have the means of impressing their will upon the people. Now, look, I know, and I'm sorry, and I don't mean to do this, but there are others with questions, and you and I are conducting a debate here on one issue, and I don't think that there's time permitting if we're to get to the other questions. But let me just say this one thing. If you're asking me to defend all the actions of the federal government, you're looking at a fella that will match you and top you with where I think the federal government is wrong. As a matter of fact, I'd like to remove a great deal of their power from them. But I have to come down that if government has any one excuse for being, a government such as ours, its only excuse can be that you and I, all of us together, have by way of government pledged that we will collectively come to the aid of and collectively defend the rights, the inherent rights, the rights by birth of even the least individual among us. And this sometimes leads to war and violence. And it is true that in any war we've ever fought, there have been people who disagreed with our rightness in being involved in that war. But we have said that as long as this is one of the areas where majority does rule in this collective security idea, and I doubt that we could possibly have a situation in which only those people believed in the cause. I could see this now with even those in military. The lieutenant says, we take Hill 875, and the fella says, wait till we take a vote to find out who wants to go.
Well, I have to point out that if you didn't find enough people who are morally committed to fight a war, then perhaps that war wouldn't be worth fighting. I think there's a direct correlation between
question.
Well, I'll tell you, you get the majority of the people to agree with you that we shouldn't be fighting this particular war, and I'm quite sure we'll stop fighting it. I have to move on because the time's moving on.
Maybe I could ask one question which might satisfy some of these, namely, can you imagine any circumstance, 1968 quite aside, under which you would like to be president of the United States?
I think that anyone looking at that job would have to be out of his skull to want to be president of the United States. I never wanted to be governor of California. And I wake up sometimes wondering how this happened. I just about had it made. If you want a personal confession, I had a sort of a television set up there that was kind of subsidized retirement. I spent about 5 days a week at the ranch, and it took a lot of soul searching and a lot of belief in some of the things that I've been expressing for me to do what I've done. No, I have no answer to that because I don't foresee it and I don't anticipate it, nor do I want it.
On Vietnam, sort of where you're getting, what sort of information you get outside of the daily newspapers, what you're posted on, without mentioning specific names.
Oh, well, I think anyone of us, particularly in this position, have contacts with people that are directly involved, ranging all the way from correspondents to industrialists, particularly in the aerospace industry and so forth, who are in and out of there at government requests.
Did you talk much to professors?
Yes.
Asian experts?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I had a meeting with a couple of them, and in my office just a few weeks ago. Now, wait a minute, fellas. There's someone right here. He is. I only have a few minutes to the next stop, and this gentleman is from the Brazilian press and came all the way to get some answers to some questions, I think. So please let me.
Governor, do you think that the
little discussion surrounded by Yale's finest.
Governor?
To begin with, yesterday, you know, there's a Brazilian journalist who's walking along. I didn't get to finish asking. You were talking about where you get your information on Vietnam, and you mentioned that you get a lot of it from industrialists, from the aerospace companies who are called over to solve specific problems. We were wondering which industrialists, and then we're also just wondering which people in the academic communities, the scholars in Vietnam that you've been talking to.
Well, I shouldn't, if I gave the impression, a lot. I don't think that they have that regular traffic back and forth. And it's just that there are people of your acquaintance, and particularly in California, where there are industries that are involved in that sort of thing. We have a high percentage of defense-type industries. In no instance, let me hasten to say, has anyone ever violated any security.
But I wonder, don't they have a certain viewpoint, you know, if they're in a defense industry, that not that they're, you know, want the business, but they tend to have a certain attitude towards the world that's tied into their business.
They're making money off the war.
You know, there's a misconception, and I'm a little disturbed that it is as prevalent as it is, because the plain truth of the matter is that, by and large, the American industrial complex stands to do far better in a peacetime economy than they do in war. There's just no question about this.
Report from Iron Mountain on the desirability of peace.
No, but I'm quite sure that you could find a viewpoint to fit anything on this. And I know that for long years there has been what I think is a myth, and this is the myth of the munition makers who were out pulling strings to create war.
I mean, that's not definitely. I wouldn't say that. But just that they're in such a business where they have an attitude.
No, in the concept, what I'm talking about is a man, let us say, who came back and he had that same tone that you read in the dispatches, the same tone that you get from the military up to a few months ago. This is the context in which we were talking, and this is the man that is a little frustrated and thinks things are going badly and what are we doing. And suddenly in recent months, not only the press, but men like this, military that are being exchanged back and forth and friends that you have, there's just a different attitude. There's a confidence and an air of we're doing all right.
Sir,
and this is what has led me to believe that we've turned a corner, that we are on the offense to such an extent that there is optimism among those who are closest engaged with the war.
Could you give us some idea? You mentioned you'd also talked to a few scholars. We were wondering what scholars on Vietnam that you've talked to, and if you've been reading people like Claude Mews or Bernard Fall or Reischauer or Fairbanks, any of those people?
These would, and you'll have to go along with me here if I don't name names. These would be individuals in our own educational structure in California. And it would range from, this might sound strange that I'm acquainted with some of the intellectual community or the academic community, but I am. And they'd range from such independent institutions as Caltech and Stanford to our own state universities.
I wonder if coming into a community like this, or generally in your own state, deciding that the group, the segment of society most vocal against the war and most concerned about it, is in many senses the group that's the best read. And I wonder, you know, the university communities, and I wonder if you ever sort of reflect on this and wonder why the university should be the greatest source of opposition to the war.
Well, now, I also have to take into consideration that in these 4 days here, out of 9,000 students at Yale, I probably haven't met individually more than 200.
No,
I would like to hear from the other 8,800.
Well, for instance, when a petition goes around here to sign the war, you know, opposing the bombing or something, you know, very quickly, large numbers of people feel quite strongly.
I think
1,300 members, professors who were in sociology at universities across the country, signed a petition opposing the war on moral and political grounds and talking about the dangers to our society.
It might be hardly unusual, but
I suggest, and with all due respect and deference then to those professors, maybe it's something that ought to be of concern to those of you who are getting the education. Regardless of his personal views, doesn't a professor have the obligation to simply teach you and expose you to all views and let you make up your mind yourself and not indoctrinate?
Well, certainly, but that's not what I was asking you about. I was just asking you how you felt.
It's possible that maybe you're being indoctrinated.
Well, I think we're being indoctrinated from all sides, ranging from Time magazine, you know, to Ramparts magazine. And I mean, the process.
How'd you read the Republican newsletter?
Governor, getting back to your visit here at Yale, I've spoken to a lot of people who've seen you in the 3 days you've been here, and I've seen you several times myself. And the one overwhelming impression that the people I've talked to get is this. They say, you're an actor, you appear very glib, very persuasive, but it's all as if it's coming out of something that's been memorized, that if they question you for more than 5 minutes, you break down, that it's all very smooth, but that it doesn't really convince them. There was a headline in the Yale Daily News today that started off in an article on you, The Actor in Politics. And this is a question that bothers me very much. I don't believe that you really have mastered the subjects you're talking about.
Well, now that's just
I'd like to say I feel that you're certainly very sincere, and I don't feel that you're acting as a member of the drama school.
I had that trouble in Hollywood, too.
Well, even if one were to try to act in front of a public group, it's an entirely different kind of acting, and you aren't doing that. I think you really are sincere. I also have worries about whether it did seem often as if when the discussion went a little longer than a quick answer, you seemed to have difficulty remembering the details of some problems. And
let me say something about
this.
How could I possibly memorize a script for a bunch of questions that I didn't know were going to be asked?
Right.
Let me tell you something that you have done and repeatedly in your class. First of all, there hasn't been any class that's only 5 minutes long. We've certainly been on the air here longer than 5 minutes. But many of you have insisted on getting onto the subject that emotionally involves you, which is Vietnam, which is not really the province of a governor. And there has been a strange lack of wanting to get into as detailed. detail or in depth about what have I done in California.
Wait just a minute.
Here again, I do not deliberately or willingly go out and volunteer stands on Vietnam. This is one of the things that you should learn, and Derek, you ought to learn this most of all if you're going to pursue journalism. There's a thing that I've learned, and now I guard myself a little better. There's no way to tell the public when they read the headline or the lead of the story how the subject came up. You go out in a press conference. You're going to make a speech. You talk entirely on California and what you've done in the state government. But the member of the press comes up, and he wants to talk to you about Vietnam. And he asks you a question. And you say to him, as I've said on any number of occasions, well, look, this isn't really a state problem, and it isn't the governor's problem. You're asking me as an individual. I'll tell you just as a citizen what I feel about Vietnam. But the headline comes out with nothing about what you said in the speech. The headline comes out, Reagan says win in Vietnam. Right. Now, the average person, even your own people, read this and they say, what's he doing going out making statements about Vietnam? You answer the question. Why doesn't the reporter honestly say the governor was here to speak about the problems of California and was asked and did say that as a citizen, his opinion was. They don't say that. It's easier to do it the other way.
Why is it that each time you've spoken about civil rights, you've talked about the integration of baseball, about Willie Mays and Jackie Robinson? It's become repetitious, and it seems to me a sad concept of civil rights if it extends to the integration of baseball. When the real problems are questions of housing, questions of the ghetto.
And all right, let me ask you something. What is the democratic machine in Chicago?
We don't like Daley.
What have they done compared to what we're doing in California? And why don't you get down to some of the specifics? And in some classes they have, and I've answered. California is the only state I know in the union that has mobilized the entire independent sector and is actually with a program in the minority pockets, aimed particularly at Negroes as well as some other minorities, but particularly there, to solve the employment problem by way of good productive jobs involving job training on a statewide basis, and is putting thousands and thousands of them into fine productive jobs. Why don't you ask that when the president called a conference in Virginia some time ago on problems of this kind, the state of California, the governor of California, each governor was supposed to be sent a representative, his personal representative. I was the only one of the 50 governors who sent a Negro, because he is my personal representative. He is on my staff. Why don't you ask that the first time in the history of the state of California that a man that was not an officer, an enlisted man, and a man that is a Negro, is the director in charge of all veterans affairs for the state of California, right?
Now, and we have heard you. I remember we heard you yesterday tell us about some of the fine appointments you've made of Negro officials in your administration. But we also asked you about, for example, the problem with Watts, and you told us about your business friend, Mr. Chad McClellan, who had gotten jobs for a number of Negroes, and we found this very admirable. But you also pointed out that then a high percentage of these Negroes moved out of Watts. And a young man asked you then, what about the remaining four, the people in the inner ghetto, the people in Watts who aren't baseball players, who aren't appointed to your administration? What to do about them? And we didn't have an answer.
Oh, yes, you did. I told you that, don't think that because I described the one program, that now the social problem of those who are not that easily employable or trainable, that we're neglecting it, that all the other programs I told you are in effect and are in working, including some additional ones such as Operation Bootstrap and others that are aimed at finding the specific reasons for the unemployment and the problems, and we are working on them. You might have been interested to know that I asked for and have legislation that has been passed that in what is an even greater minority in California, and a minority that has a lower level of education, a higher rate of dropout, and a lower level of employment than the Negro, is the American of Mexican descent. And one of the great reasons that we've discovered for this problem in education, our children come to school who've heard nothing but Spanish in their homes. And we've passed legislation now that we're going to put dual language teachers in those schools so that a teacher will be able to find out in the child's home language whether his inability to get a subject or get an answer is because of lack of language knowledge, and thus can get them on. This is, we have a number of things of this kind, but with regard to whether you can handle the job, I would think that I voluntarily stated, because I didn't think anyone was going to ask me, and they didn't, about some of the things that have led to our ability to reduce a budget by $127 million.
I think you'll find that the students here, which you described as liberal or liberal Democrats, are in many ways, sure, or many of the same attitudes with your, you know, are very dissatisfied with the so-called, you know, liberalism of a person like Lyndon Johnson or the machine Democratic politics. But the problem comes down to, I mean, and we share many of the same anxieties and frustrations even about the war, but the problem comes down to solutions and ways to do it. And it seems to us, at least, that yours is, in a sense, a retrogressive.
As a governor of California, I not only didn't declare the war, I can't end the war.
No, but not end the war, but all, I mean, the whole range of problems. We have many similar, you know, attitudes. And
you gave what I thought was a very good critique of the failure of public housing to meet the problems of the ghetto. But your solution seemed to me to go in the wrong direction, was to go back again to rely on private housing. There wouldn't be a need.
I said that I favored and believed that because there seems to be a lack of motivation in the area of public housing, that the individual in there lacks all the motivation that makes any other human being take care of the place where he lives, have some concern about the neighborhood and so forth. The crime has increased and all these things. I suggested that why don't we start exploring and experimenting to find out why we lack this, and I made the proposal, why don't we experiment with injecting pride of ownership and try a public housing project, at least try one, in which we give the individual the actual ownership.
Does this correlate to the Percy plan that he's announced?
I haven't read his in detail, but there might be some similarities.
I would like to ask one small question about Vietnam, and I will not ask any more about it. Simply, I was talking to a kid who used to live across the street from you, and he described how he once brought a copy of Conscience of the Conservative over to his father's, rather liberal, to read. And I wonder if we, in turn, would send you just one or two books on Vietnam, would you at least try 20 or 30 pages of the book?
Listen, you underestimate me. I tried to tell you one day, I am only recently a Republican. I was a New Deal Democrat. I was the most bleeding heart of liberals you ever saw. I think I have probably as good an understanding as anyone does of the thought processes of the liberal. I was there. I sat where you now sit. And I do read both sides. As a matter of fact, I have an inquiring mind. I may not have managed to catch up with as many of the most recent things, but then I would have to tell you, and I could ask Nancy to verify it for me, when you get to be governor, one of the things that bothers you is that you find yourself at night, and Derek, this is one of those corrections of one of your statements, you find yourself with a full briefcase of memorandums and reports that must be digested because the next day decisions are going to have
would
to
you
be made.
If I sent you, I mean, you wouldn't take it, you'd take it nicely, I mean, not going to return it or anything.
Of course not. I'd be very happy to get them and hope that usually I snatch chapters here and there or something I'm trying to read other than these things.
That I always felt I knew what his response was going to be. It was going to be an okay type response.
Did any of you ever see a situation where students were able to ruffle him, to shake him?
Yes, I saw one where he was pressed about the poor taking part in the poverty program and making their own decisions. And to this he said that he didn't believe and the poor should participate. He didn't believe that anyone who couldn't control their own lives and their own destinies should participate in administrative decision-making for programs meant to help them control their destinies. The student then pressed him and asked if he didn't believe in letting the poor learn by doing. And he said he didn't know about letting people learn by doing, especially when they couldn't control their own affairs. And then the student responded with, but Governor, for the last 11 months, you've been learning by doing. And this stopped him for a little bit. But being, again, the word performance, being an actor, he recovered his poise quickly and went to another question.
Leonard, as the associate Chubb Fellow, you had a chance to see the governor during his whole visit and in the private occasions and as well as the public occasions. Now, was there any difference in his pose in private or in public?
I think the constant presence of the press, the very vivid presence with cameras and newspaper men did make a good deal of difference and reduced him a little bit to the formula that we're used to seeing him in, to the figure of the public relations product. And with students especially, he was much more a human being who was reacting emotionally to some questions, who liked to talk about some things and didn't like to talk about other things.
What didn't he like to talk about?
Oh, he didn't like to talk about Vietnam. He several times privately to me